Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today on the show, I'm joined by author Peter Janney, who wrote the book Mary's Mosaic, which came out in 2012. The description on the back of the book goes like this: a shocking expose on the life and death of political peace activist Mary Pinchot Meyer, whose relationship with John F. Kennedy sheds new light on the circumstances surrounding his assassination. The author, Peter Janney, is a baby boomer who grew up in Washington, D.C., son of a high-ranking CIA official during the Cold War era of the 1950s and 60s, mingling with many of Washington's social and political elite, including the family of Cord and Mary Pinchot Meyer. A 1970 graduate of Princeton, Janney completed a doctoral degree in psychology at Boston University and has been an entrepreneurial psychologist for over 30 years. In 2002, he earned an MBA degree from the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. Janney currently resides by the sea in Beverly, Massachusetts. Peter Janney, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Now, maybe you could tell our listening audience, who was Mary Pinchot Meyer, and why did you decide to write a book about her?
Well, Mary Pinchot Meyer was of my parents' generation. I'm currently 65, and this is the emerging World War II post-generation that came out of the war. And she was, first of all, incredibly beautiful, possibly one of the most beautiful women of an entire generation. And she came from a very wealthy, aristocratic family. Her uncle was Gifford Pinchot, a two-time governor of the state of Pennsylvania. Her father was Amos Pinchot, who was one of the co-founders of the American Civil Liberties Union. It was a very progressive family. And the kids, the children, she and her sister, actually, were really given a sort of classic education, but supported to really become self-actualized in their childhood and in their adulthood. So she was a free spirit. Mary was an incredibly free spirit and, of course, very, very sought after. And one of the people who did seek her out was John Kennedy when he was growing up. They actually met at a prep school dance in the winter of 1936, and he spotted her and kept cutting in on the dance floor and kind of wouldn't. He just was mesmerized by her, and that was sort of their first meeting.
And then why did you decide to write a book about her?
Well, I knew Mary Meyer because she was the mother of my best friend. Mary had also gone to college with my mother. They were in the same class at college. And so there was this group of people that were living in Washington, D.C. in the late 40s, early 1950s, of which Mary and her husband, Cord Meyer, and their family were part of that scene. And so I knew the family quite well. We socialized together. We spent a lot of time together. And of course, I was best friends with her middle child, who was killed by a car when we were both 9 years old. It was a very seminal kind of event in my life, sort of introducing me to the world of grief and loss at a very early age, and it made an indelible impact on me.
And so you decided to write the book because you knew her as a close family friend?
Mary was very, very helpful to me after her son Michael's death. I mean, my parents were not what I would call very well equipped to handle this kind of event and its impact on me. And as I said a few minutes ago, you know, Mary was very highly developed as an individual. And, of course, the loss of a child for any parent is possibly one of the most devastating, tragic losses life can give. But even amidst her own grief, Mary was very instrumental in just helping me manage my own loss. I mean, I still spent time with the family. I still went over to their house, even though Michael was gone, and she would hold me and allow my sadness, things like that, which, of course, my own parents were very ambivalent about. They just didn't know how to handle it very well. So I began to have this relationship with my best friend's mother, and as I got older, I didn't see her as frequently, but then, of course, I didn't hear about her death until about 5 weeks after it took place, because I was away at boarding school, and I came home in the fall of 1964 for Thanksgiving vacation, and on the night before Thanksgiving, it was announced at the dinner table to me, just kind of casually, that she had died, that she had been murdered, da-da-da-da-da, and it floored me. I mean, it just very, really had quite a huge impact on me, and I sort of carried this with me for many, many years, and it wasn't until I was in training in graduate school as a clinical psychologist that I began to really begin to unravel this whole ordeal and what had taken place. So her murder increasingly came into my foreground because it was unsolved. And when the news came out in 1976 that she had had an affair with President Kennedy, which I didn't know about, very few people did, but there was a group of people who did, but I wasn't among them. I began to just have sneaking suspicions that this wasn't just a random act of violence, that there was foul play here. So little by little, I started to go to work on this and spent the better part of 35 years researching it on and off. Of course, coming into about 2003, 2004 is when I really decided that I had to get serious here and fish or cut bait and put this thing together or walk away. And so the result of that was Mary's Mosaic.
Yeah, and a friend of mine bought the book and I took it immediately from him and I started reading it and I couldn't put it down. It's like really a great, you know, well-written and really a fascinating story.
Oh, I'm glad you like it.
So Mary was pretty involved with JFK.
Well, yes, I think she was quite involved with him, particularly during the last 3 years of his life. You know, Mary was not taken by JFK when she met him when she was 15 years old in 1936. I mean, she was already pretty smart, and she could see that he was kind of a superficial playboy type. And I think they saw each other in college once or twice, but they weren't dating. I mean, there wasn't a romance going on at that time. Mary was really interested in people who were a lot more serious than JFK was at the time. You know, he was kind of a party animal back then. But they traveled in the same social circles. And I think it wasn't until after her divorce from her husband, Cord Meyer, in 1958, that things began to show a possibility that they might change. And of course, as he was preparing to run for president, they had a little more interaction, but there still was no love relationship going on. That really came right around the time of the election, just after the election, into late 1960, 61.
And so did Mary question how he died, the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
Yes, she did. The last year of her life, 1964, she spent the better part of a year, I believe, researching what had really taken place in Dallas. And this was a woman who had extraordinary reach and influence. I mean, she lived in Washington. She knew all the players in Washington. She was able to talk to people who really knew more of the truth of what actually did take place with the assassination. And she was increasingly convinced by the middle of 1964, summer of 1964, that the Central Intelligence Agency had been instrumental in creating the kind of plan that would allow the president to be uprooted and, so to speak, taken care of. So let's not forget, I think it's important for your listeners to understand, that Mary was actually murdered less than three weeks after the official Warren Commission report came out in late September. 1964, September 24th, I think. And she was murdered on October 12th. And there's some significant evidence that shows that she was about to go public with what she knew. And this was not like just anyone saying the things that she was going to say. I mean, she was a person with some substantial credibility in and around Washington. And, of course, the worst thing the powers that be wanted to not see happen was to have someone like her come out and stridently oppose what the Warren Commission was trying to convince people of.
And wasn't her ex-husband, Cord Meyer, he was in the CIA, correct? And a lot of their family friends were, and your father was as well, correct?
That's correct. And they were all friends with each other. I mean, you know, this is a very elite kind of group of people, most of whom who have grown up with very privileged, wealthy backgrounds, and they kind of feel like the world is their oyster, and they can do anything they want, and that the general rules of law don't apply to them.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to read a quote from your book and then ask you to respond to it.
Okay.
In the introduction, you say, "There was nothing pretty or easy about waking up early one morning in 2006 and finally realizing that my own father, Wistar Janney, a career high-level CIA officer, had been involved in the, quote, termination of Mary Pinchot Meyer, someone I had grown to love and care about."
Yes, that was, I would think, probably one of the most difficult moments for me in writing this book, that I was immersed in this research for a number of years. And there was a real pivotal moment, an aha moment, where I realized when I had put what had taken place, when I put it all together in front of me, so to speak, I saw how my father had been part of this conspiracy to terminate her life. And it was not an easy moment. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I could really appreciate that wouldn't be. Yeah.
No, it was difficult, but yet I think it's very important, because the whole purpose of writing this book is to try and correct the historical record. People need to know what the real truth is of their country. Otherwise, as a country, we go on recreating the same mistakes over and over again. And things don't change, they get worse. And without the truth, I think people have to understand that we can't go forward in a profoundly new way without knowing the real truth of our history. And that would be one's personal history as well as one's collective history as well as a country's history.
Can you tell us a little bit about who Leo Damour, am I saying his name right, Leo Damour was and what he was all about?
Yes, Leo Damour was a well-established author. I think probably the apex of his literary careers. He wrote this book called Senatorial Privilege. It was the story of what happened at Chappaquiddick with Senator Edward Kennedy and Mary Jo Kopechne and what that whole story was really about. And, of course, Leo was a prodigious researcher. I met Leo in 1992, and he was already well into his own research about the story of Mary Meyer, and he and I became sort of instant friends. We saw eye to eye on any number of things. And so I credit Leo really with creating the kind of realization for me as to what was really going on here behind the scenes. And it was Leo's work that really helped me take this book to its logical end. The story of Leo is a very tragic one in some way, because I believe, on the basis of evidence, that he really did finally get to interview on the telephone Mary's assassin, or someone who was part of the assassination team to kill her. That happened at the end of March in 1993, and 2 years later, Leo would be dead. I mean, he did shoot himself in the presence of a nurse and a policeman, but I believe that he was driven to take his own life, that he had become clinically depressed. I think there's a very good possibility that he had been poisoned and, in a sense, driven into the kind of despair that makes people just want to exit life in general.
So So you have a lot of the resources that he was using?
Yes. When I really, in earnest, made the decision that I was going to finish this book or finish this effort, I sought out Leo's former research assistant, and he had saved all of Leo's research. So I was able to procure this vast file of documents, tapes, etc., and then I bought the copyrights to the material from the family, and it all worked out.
In the book, you talk about Lee Harvey Oswald as having connections to the CIA or the intelligence community. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think there's quite a bit of very good evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald was a member of the intelligence community. His defection to Russia in 1959 was a false defection. The CIA had a program that was actually run out of Nag's Head, North Carolina. It was run through the Office of Naval Intelligence, and it was a sort of false defector program where they would send people into places like Russia, making it look like they were defecting from our country when, in fact, they had been sent in there to gather whatever information they possibly could. And I think I'm not the first person to go on record subscribing to this. Victor Marchetti, who worked for the CIA, was convinced that Oswald was a product of this program. Someone else who worked in the CIA, who I know quite well, came across the report on Oswald when he returned to the country. Even though Oswald's name wasn't mentioned specifically in the report, there weren't that many Americans who had been working in a radio factory in Minsk, Russia, who had returned to the United States. I mean, it was clear that they were talking about Oswald, even though that his name wasn't mentioned in the report. So there are a lot of significant pieces of evidence that certainly point to the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald had intelligence connections. He had a CIA handler when he was in Dallas who positioned him into working into the Texas School Book Depository, right where the president was shot, things like that. This was a very carefully laid out plan in terms of creating enough superficial evidence to help people believe, oh yes, this was just a lone nut assassin who went crazy and shot the president. It just didn't happen that way. And people really, despite what people like Bill O'Reilly try and tell us, and, you know, of course, his book gets made into a movie readily, but any book that tells a different story, and particularly tells the story that our own government was involved in this situation, is shunned. I mean, I can't even get my book reviewed in a major newspaper. There isn't one media outlet in Washington, D.C., where I grew up. And this is arguably Washington, D.C.'s most famous unsolved murder. There isn't one media outlet that would review my book, talk about it, have me on any show, radio program, that kind of thing. That's how this effort has been treated.
But that's really telling. You must be onto something if they won't cover it.
No, they won't. They're going to have to probably begin to cover something because there's going to be a new edition of the book coming out in September. And by new edition, I mean there's going to be a new postscript chapter in the book, because after Mary's Mosaic came out last year in April 2012, I was finally able to locate the man who I allege in the book was part of the assassination team or even the trigger man. We don't know. But I finally found him, and I confronted him on his doorstep in Northern California last August, and he was not at all pleased that I had found him. But there's going to be some other events coming up around that in the next couple of months.
Wow, you're pretty courageous to do that.
Well, few of my friends would tell you that they think I'm crazy, but I was just too close not to go through with it, even though it was a little anxiety-racking. But I'm very pleased that I did do it, and I secretly tape recorded what little conversation this guy would have with me, although it didn't last very long because he was just so upset and enraged that I had finally found him.
Now, when does the second edition come out?
The second edition will come out right after Labor Day. It's already has its own Amazon page as a pre-order. It'll be paperback. It's essentially the same book, but with this postscript chapter, with certain events that took place and there are going to be a couple of other surprises, which I don't want to give away right at this point.
Okay. All right. I want to read another passage from the book and ask you to respond to that.
Okay.
So after more than 20 years of my own study, I share the belief, based on substantiated evidence and research by a host of dedicated researchers and historians, that President Kennedy was ambushed by elements of his own national security apparatus in what amounted to a coup d'etat. It is clear that a highly compartmentalized elite segment of the CIA, the U.S. military, the U.S. Secret Service, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, certain well-known organized crime figures, and finally Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson, all colluded to overthrow the elected government of the U.S.
Yes. In a nutshell, I think that's what happened. I think that there's an increasing volume of research that has come out in the form of books that for any discerning citizen who wants to educate themselves about this event clearly demonstrates the level of conspiracy that took place here. I mean, in some ways I could say the evidence is almost overwhelming.
Tell us a little bit about Lyndon Johnson, the evidence for his involvement.
Oh my God. There's a book by another author by the name of Phil Nelson. Now, I don't completely subscribe to his thesis. He believes LBJ, you know, masterminded the whole plan. I don't believe that. But LBJ, people should understand, on the very day of the assassination, was being investigated in the United States Senate, that he had been involved in bribery. He had been involved in all kinds of illegal activity. His career as a politician was about to abruptly come to an end. He was finished. And I think he knew, as power-hungry as he was, he knew that he would never get elected president, that the only way he would end up being president would be if President Kennedy died or was assassinated. And I think he was much more willing to play the game with the Pentagon and the CIA in terms of doing whatever it is they wanted to do, because JFK wasn't. I mean, JFK, after the Cuban Missile Crisis in the fall of 1962, he really started to turn in an entirely new direction, away from the Cold War and toward the province of world peace. And of course, I maintain one of his biggest influences in that transformation was Mary Meyer. I think she was really helping him see the futility of what the Cold War mentality was doing, and that if there was going to be another Cuban Missile Crisis, the world would likely end. I mean, it almost did in October of 62. So I think he was really a changed individual in many ways, that he had made some really major decisions in terms of his presidential trajectory. And so the biggest evidence of that is his American University speech on June 10th, 1963, where he really, in a sense, tells everyone that peace is the only province to pursue here, and that he and Khrushchev are going to do it together. He announced during that speech that he was going to create the first limited nuclear arms treaty. That took place with an incredible amount of speed. Basically, he announced it in June, and the Senate ratified the treaty in September. The speed with which that took place was just unprecedented. And of course, the reason it was unprecedented was because he did it in secret. He wouldn't let the CIA know what was going on. He wouldn't let the Pentagon know what was going on. I mean, he was really off the reservation, and they knew they could no longer control him. Whereas with someone like Vice President Johnson, they knew he would be a team player. And Kennedy wanted to end the war in Vietnam. Well, we know LBJ did the exact opposite. And Kennedy wanted to make peace with Castro in Cuba, and LBJ, again, did the exact opposite. LBJ was content to be the puppet of the national security apparatus, and JFK decided that he would no longer do that.
Right, and so there's all those reasons why they would want to get rid of him. I know he had talked about dismantling the CIA.
That's right. If he got reelected, he would have really neutered the CIA in terms of their capacity to have a paramilitary unit and continue to overthrow other democratically elected governments, that kind of thing. He was going to end that for sure. And the CIA knew that if he got reelected, their days were numbered.
Now, earlier you talked about the importance of knowing our history and knowing what happened, because if we don't, then these things keep happening and they get worse. Can you make any connections between the JFK assassination and RFK, Martin Luther King, and even 9/11?
Well, yes. I think, again, on the basis of evidence, I think people really need to understand that these are not random events, as the media would like to have us believe. For instance, with Martin Luther King's assassination, there's an attorney by the name of William Pepper who, in 1998, represented the King family, and in a civil action, a wrongful death lawsuit, the family sued this guy, Lloyd Jowers, and other unnamed co-conspirators, and Mr. Pepper, Attorney Pepper, took this to trial for 30 days and called over 70 witnesses. And at the end of the trial, the jury took less than an hour to come back and not only indict this guy, Lloyd Jowers, who was a former Memphis policeman, but also indicted the United States government for their complicity in Martin Luther King's assassination on the basis of evidence that was presented at the trial. So that's the thing that I want people to begin to understand, that we have been given a false narrative about what happened in these major political events. Robert Kennedy's assassination is another case in point. And again, this same attorney, William Pepper, is attempting to reopen that case and present in a judicial proceeding evidence to support that there was at least two, possibly four shooters in that assassination. And all of the bullets that struck Robert Kennedy were from behind, and Sirhan Sirhan came at him from the front. There's no way you can look at this case on the basis of evidence and again say that Sirhan is this lone nut assassin who was just crazy. It just didn't happen that way. But there has been so much suppression of information and evidence. And for that, I blame the media. The media today is largely corporate-driven. There are very few courageous, bright, shining lights out there who are willing to attempt to tell the truth. I mean, you look at someone like Chris Hedges, who was a former Pulitzer Prize writer for the New York Times. He was fired because he didn't support the war in Iraq. The same with Phil Donahue, who used to be on MSNBC. He was fired because he came out and outspoke against the war in Iraq, saying that we were being led into war under false pretenses, of course, and everyone knows today that, in fact, that is what took place. But you see, without a free press, without a separate entity that cannot be co-opted by the national security apparatus, we're really at the mercy of what people are getting fed. And the problem is that we have an educational system that is so deteriorated that people don't understand growing up that the province of critical thinking is an essential element of any educational experience. And if people aren't being taught to think critically, then they just become spoon-fed. They'll believe anything.
I work in education, and I see the pressures there to not challenge the status quo.
Right.
You've just been listening to the first part of an interview with author Peter Janney, who wrote the book Mary's Mosaic. Mary Pinchot Meyer was intimately involved with John Kennedy and was herself murdered approximately 1 year after his assassination. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of this interview. You'll hear about Mary's own murder and Janney's thoughts on 9/11. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.